and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank provides this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Companies or its affiliates. If you have any questions during the call, please email them to David_Lundgren@HancockBank, and we'll be happy to address those at the end of the call. Today I have with me John Portwood, Chief Investment Officer, David Lundgren, Director of Equities and Research, and Jeffrey Tangus, Director of Fixed Income. Dave, please take over.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to another installment of our monthly economic update call. John, you know, I guess the most obvious topic and the hottest topic on the news and in the markets is in regards to the political discussion surrounding the debt ceiling, possible default or downgrade in the deficit. So bring us up to date on what's going on there.
Okay, I think everybody probably knows that the House passed the bill last night. It's something of a foregone conclusion that the bill will pass the Senate today. Unfortunately, if any of you have paid any attention to the research reports and commentaries that are coming out today, the bill really provided no real solution to the debt issues going forward. I guess on the bright side, we can say it's a step in the right direction, but there are going to be a lot more wailing and gnashing of teeth and fighting before we finally come up with something that makes some sense from the standpoint of a long-term solution. So it's conceivable as the years go by, and it will probably take years to fix this problem, that we'll careen from one crisis to another, something similar to what we're seeing today, or at least there'll be a lot of political wrangling before something is done. But, that's kind of the basic story, a step in the right direction, a small step, but there's a whole lot more to go.
Let's talk specifically about a downgrade of U.S. debt. I saw where on Intrade the probability of a downgrade was at 60% the other day. I'm not sure where it was this morning. That looks like there's a pretty good chance that that's going to occur. What do you think the probabilities are, and then what are the implications if the U.S. is downgraded to AA+?
Besides what Dave just mentioned on Intrade, we've seen a number of research reports who have looked at the data and looked at the commentary from Standard & Poor's and Moody's and the other rating agencies and come to the conclusion that a downgrade is almost inevitable. So it is probably the case that a potential downgrade and the likelihood of a downgrade is already in the markets at this point. And, even today there were some people on Bloomberg News talking about a downgrade and how it seemed to be, already generally accepted by a lot of people, unless a lot of really major progress is made currently in tackling the long-term debt issues that we have. So to some degree, it could be already in the market, if, as appears to be the case, a downgrade looks like it will be inevitable. Now, what kind of impact would it have on the market? Theoretically, it would mean higher borrowing costs for the country, and if treasuries were downgraded to AA+ instead of AAA, if rates rose on treasuries, it might mean rates would rise on munis, corporates, anything connected, I guess, to the quality rating of the bond. However, since not much has happened currently, and since interest rates are behaving very well, largely due to what's happening, I guess, economically in the face of the potential downgrade, and considering the fact that if we are downgraded, we're still the best game in town, relatively speaking, because the only other market deep enough to accept a lot of money for investment purposes or something that might be considered as potentially acceptable as a reserve currency would be the euro, and they're in much worse condition than we are, in much worse trouble with what's happening to the pigs. The other AAA-rated countries like Germany, Australia, for example, Canada, are simply not big enough and don't have the market depth, you know, to handle, you know, a reserve currency status like us. So it's beginning to look like a downgrade might be somewhat upsetting in terms of interest rates, but maybe not significantly. You know, it may be, in effect, a non-event, particularly if it's already in the market.
John, could I add one little point to that?
Yeah.
And one thing that gets lost in all this is that the U.S. actually has a short-term and a long-term rating. And when everybody talks of a downgrade, they're talking about the long-term debt of the country. T-bills and things, short-term instruments of that sort, are actually falling under, they fall under the short-term rating for S&P and Moody's. And in that case, they will still be essentially what's AAA rated, A1 plus is S&P's is a rating system for short-term securities. So actually, short-term securities will remain at the highest AAA. It's the long-term debt that will be downgraded.
That's a good point, Jeff. Thank you for bringing that up. John, obviously, we're not the only country that has our debt issues or deficit issues. What's the latest on the European debt crisis? Any new news there?
The latest plan to save Greece is still, I think, a plan in progress. I don't think they have yet quite worked out an agreement concerning restructuring Greek debt, which in effect would be a default of some sort. But the plan is currently to restructure the debt and extend maturity maybe out as far as 30 years. And it's a rather complex plan. They haven't really come up with a final, any final numbers on that, and we don't yet at this point know what, you know, the rating agencies might do. They might call credit default, a credit event, that will create a problem for Greece if that occurs. As far as all of the countries are concerned, like Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain, the most likely countries that will be pressured eventually into some sort of default or restructuring, in addition to Greece, would be Portugal and Ireland. Spain would be next in line, I guess, and then finally, you know, it would be Italy, that already has a pretty high debt ratio relative to GDP. So that's another ongoing problem. It's much worse than ours. And probably, ultimately, a number of those countries are going to have to leave the euro, or the Germans and the French and other countries that have the money and the taxpayer base to do it are just going to have to bail them out. And nobody knows exactly how that's going to work out, but, you know, that's another crisis that's ongoing and will probably continue for a number of years. So the only plan that they come up with so far, again, this one on Greece, in effect, kicks the can down the road, to use that overused phrase, just like we're doing with, the debt limit bill.
Okay. Let's shift back to the U.S. and talk about the economy a little bit. Real GDP for the second quarter was revised downward from 1.9% all the way down to 0.4%. The ISM manufacturing survey number that came out yesterday was at a much lower than expected 50.9, and that was the lowest reading since the summer of 2009. The consumer spending number that came in this morning was also on the weak side. This weaker tone for the economy here continues. What are your thoughts?
If you'll remember, what I wrote about in the highlights was the likelihood that the trend line growth rate for GDP in the future would be more on the order of, say, 2% plus in the long run rather than 3% plus that we're used to thinking about as being the long-run trend growth for the economy. That's not necessarily a disaster. It sort of puts us in the frame of Europe for the last 20 or 30 years. Their average GDP growth rate has been something like 2% annualized, you know, roughly 25-30% below ours, you know, for the last few decades. If we have, so to speak, become Europe due to our debt issues and changing in demographics, then maybe a 2% growth rate is what we ought to expect going forward. If that is the case, then it is not necessarily true that a 2% year-over-year or below a 2% year-over-year GDP growth rate, which is where we are now, is a forerunner of recession. You know, it may be that if 2% growth is what our future will be, then perhaps 1% growth rates for quarters here and there might not be unusual. You know, it might not necessarily be a harbinger of recession. A lot of people are worried about that currently, but there are other indicators that suggest, you know, recession is not really in the cards. The bank credit analyst runs a recession probability gauge that is still relatively flat, you know, whereas in 2007 it was rising fairly quickly, indicating a high probability of recession. The leading economic indicators are still positive. The growth rate of leading economic indicators is not as high as it used to be, but at least it's positive, you know, suggesting that recession is not around the corner. And one little indicator that I look at fairly often to get a gauge of what might be happening in real time is produced by the Consumer Metrics Institute, and they measure online sales of consumer discretionary items, and they do have some housing data in there as well, as, you know, auto data and the other, you know, online consumer purchases that you might think of. They believe that their number represents about 25% of retail activity, and they understand there is a demographic bias to online sales. But in any case, their particular number has been in contraction mode for a number of months, almost a year, really, in fact, indicating that, you know, something, you know, relatively negative was happening as far as online sales were concerned. In the last 2 months, that number has improved markedly. And while they haven't been doing this for too many years, you know, the current data would indicate that that might be a fairly early leading indicator. So as long as that number continues to improve, it may indicate that consumer spending has reached a bottom and that some sort of upswing is underway, in contrast to this 9-month contraction that they are, that their number was, their index was producing previously. So, you know, that's one ray of hope, I guess, for the future in terms of the second half being, you know, at least positive. You know, our guess for the second half has been that it's going to be 2% plus, you know, for a long time. In fact, we sort of, you know, considered 2% plus rather than 3% plus as being a reasonable guess about, you know, what the potential for the economy was like. And by the way, for the last 10 years, certainly, well, more than that, I guess the last 11 years following the bursting of the tech bubble in 2000, average growth rate of GDP has not been 3. It's been more like 1.8, 1.9. You know, obviously, the two recessions we've had, you know, put a big dent in that 10-year number. But in any case, there are a lot of signals out there that indicate, you know, 2% growth rate is probably more like what we're going to experience rather than the 3 we've had in the past. So I'm somewhat hopeful that, you know, rather than being a forerunner of recession, the numbers we're seeing now just simply indicates a mushy economic situation within a much lower trend line growth rate and perhaps higher than average unemployment for maybe much longer than we would like. So it's something that I guess we'll just have to get used to over time.
Okay. Before we talk about stocks, just as a reminder, everyone, if you have any questions that you'd like for John to answer, please go ahead and email those questions to me at David_Lundgren, L-U-N-D-G-R-E-N, at HancockBank.com. Okay, John, let's talk about stocks. July was a pretty ugly month. The S&P was down 2%. Through yesterday, year-to-date, the S&P 500 is now up 3.4%. Seems like every month lately we've been giving a little bit back. Amidst all the bad news, however, it looks like earnings for the second quarter are going to be relatively strong, up almost 20% on a year-over-year basis. Couple questions. With such poor economic news, how are companies producing strong earnings? Can it continue? And then secondly, how much damage has the political turmoil done to the market in confidence, and what is your outlook for the remainder of the year? Two questions in there.
Yeah, that's
Well, I'll just start with the earnings.
I'll start with the earnings.
Strong earnings, 20% year-over-year in the midst of some bad economic news. How are companies doing that?
Companies have really had enjoyed the benefit of high profit margins ever since we bounced off the bottom back in 2008, early 2009. In fact, the profit margins now are as high as they ever have been. And unfortunately, there's a tendency for profit margins to mean revert over time. So we're probably not going to see much more increase in profit margin from this point, I guess. Profit margins are probably about as high as they're going to get. Companies have, enjoyed, other advantages from the standpoint of layoffs, not hiring, better productivity using machines instead of men, that sort of thing. That's been going on for a long time. And all of that has produced some good numbers on the bottom line. Now, that 20% gain in profits year over year toward the end of last year was much greater than that. I can't remember what the number was, but it was big. I'm going to say it might have been as much as 150%. Above trend. In other words, you had about a 50% gain at one point. So profits have been decelerating. The growth rate in profits has been decelerating since last year. And that's pretty normal as a cycle matures. The good news is that as long as that number is positive, in other words, the growth rate may be declining, but earnings are still expanding, even if at lower rates. That's generally a pretty good environment for common stocks. At least you don't run into tremendous downtrends very often, unless you see something happen on the negative side in earnings. So far the outlook looks pretty good, even though that kind of earnings pace will not be continued. From a valuation standpoint, looking at it cyclically, valuation is kind of neutral. Stocks don't look particularly cheap. They don't look particularly expensive based on valuation measures that assume, say, a 2% plus GDP growth rate going forward. I guess, if things, pretty much stay where they are today, then valuation numbers are roughly neutral. The interesting thing about what's happening dynamically within the market is that there appears to be no selling pressure out there. We buy some information from services that track buying and selling pressure, and the market decline to date from the high appears to be accompanied more by a reluctance to buy rather than any evidence of an increase in the desire to sell. So it's almost like, the buyers have backed away from buying rather than sellers getting particularly active. So, that's been a pretty good sign recently in terms of the market. But it's hard to predict really what's going to happen going forward. But considering that the market has held up relatively well in the face of a lot of negative news lately, suggests that it's going to take a lot more negative news than what we've seen so far to push the market over the edge. But obviously, we're not going to make a lot of progress from this point forward on the major indices, and it's probably going to be more of a stock selection situation, to deliver above average returns.
I've heard a lot of strategists comment that they had concerns that all of the political wrangling, as you put it, the turmoil that we've been in as of late is beginning to weigh on the confidence of consumers and market participants. How does that factor into, I guess, a couple things, the recent market activity? Is that what we're seeing, people losing confidence in the system and thereby, getting nervous about the market and pulling out? And how long does it, as long as this deficit problem is out there here in the U.S., does that weigh on the market for an extended period of time?
It could. Obviously, confidence, while it's not necessarily a good indicator to use in terms of where the market's going in the future, if confidence remains low for a long period of time, then it certainly suggests that it's going to have an impact on economic activity. and I guess an impact on market psychology. If you look at the University of Michigan, I believe it's University of Michigan's confidence index compared to the S&P 500 over time, you see that they tend to move together. You know, market goes down, confidence goes down. The market and confidence kind of reach a low about the same time and go up again together. This time, the market has bounced off the low back in 2009, and confidence really hasn't budged. And going back in history, I'm not aware of a time where that has really happened before. So that's probably significant in the sense that it gives you an idea of what's happening out there in the economy and what's happening to the psychology of investors and businessmen. So it probably is another indication that we're going through a slower period of growth, an uncertain market, maybe for a number of years. You don't really know. Again, it gets back, I think, to the theme of selecting sectors and industries and maybe regions of the world to try to gain some extra return, because it probably, from this point forward, won't be particularly exciting for the major market indices.
Okay. Jeff, you still there?
Still here.
All right. I'm confused and I need your assistance. I guess, over the last month, we've seen Treasury yields actually go down across the curve. And I guess with all the talk about default and downgrade, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It seems like if there was speculation or concern about a credit possibly defaulting or being downgraded, if anything, you'd see a rise in yields. And we actually saw the 10-year drop to 2.75% yesterday. I think that was the lowest level in about 9 months. Give us some insight on why this might occur and where do we go from here?
Well, there's a lot of things at work here, as is normally the case. Probably the explanation starts out with thinking about where we're coming from. Not long ago, at the end of June, was the end of quantitative easing 2, where everybody assumed that without the Federal Reserve buying more treasuries as they had been, that it was just a given that rates were going up for treasury bonds. You had some bond market titans like PIMCO, Bill Gross, high profile, saying why would anybody want to own a treasury? So probably treasuries were underowned and the expectations were very low. That was the situation coming into this whole debt ceiling debate. And then, of course, in the course of all this, the specter of a downgrade first surfaced. And it seemed on the surface, like you're saying, to be a negative event. But one of the things that happened along the way is that the market realized that, hey, the economy was already slowing down, and that all of this debate would likely lead to more fiscal austerity. So that led to the prospect of the economy slowing, the deflationary, which that was another powerful motivator for rates to move down. Then on top of that is the kind of the perverse nature of all this, in that if there is a downgrade to the federal debt, say from AAA to AA, then it doesn't mean everybody's going to go out and sell treasuries. Actually, portfolio managers, especially institutional portfolio managers who manage a portfolio off of an average quality, and we'll just throw out a letter and say a portfolio average is A. Well, if a big part of your portfolio or a significant part is in treasuries, and treasuries are downgraded from AAA to AA, to maintain the average of A, that means you don't get rid of the higher quality. They're still the higher quality securities, so to maintain the A average, you can't get rid of the high quality investments. You actually have to go out and sell the lower quality investments, which might be high yield or junk bonds per se, which have very low ratings, or it might just be triple B rated corporates at the end. So the perverse nature of Wall Street, which seems to do the most it can to fool most of the people most of the time, it actually led people to realize that this would, if not create demand, some demand for more treasuries to maintain an average quality. It certainly would at least lead people to have to lower their allocation towards lower quality. So all those things, a slowing economy, under ownership in treasuries, the fact that to maintain an average quality you have to own more higher quality securities, not less. All of that combined and conspired basically to do what you say, push yields down to 2.75, and we've seen lots of credible reports that before it's all over with, as this economy slows down, we could see treasury rates even lower, as low as maybe 2.5% on the 10-year. So it's not always what it seems on the surface in the bond world.
All right, great. Thank you, Jeff. Just a reminder, everyone, if you have any questions, please email them to me, david_lundgren@hancockbank.com. And I do have a couple of questions that have come in, and I'm going to throw them out to both John and Jeff. And they're related to the downgrade, and they're kind of interrelated. The first question, would S&P or any rating agency, I guess, wait until after? I believe part of the legislation is that there's going to be a government debt cutting commission that are going to, I guess, the next phase of cuts. Will the rating agencies wait for results out of that commission before taking any action? And then in the second part, the other question that's kind of related, does it make sense to downgrade a country that can borrow for 10 years at 2.7%?
Go ahead, Jeff. You can answer that as well as I can.
Well, yeah, I was just going to take a quick stab at it, only because that situation is changing actually by the minute, and it's really because there are no hard and fast rules here. What's happening is, of course, the administration was meeting with S&P last night, as a matter of fact, trying to talk to them and say to take a wait-and-see approach to their downgrade. They were the more aggressive. Moody's backed off already and was already taking a softer line. So it seems clear that Moody's is not of a mind to make an immediate downgrade. S&P was the one who was more likely to do something sooner and more drastic. And, as I say, the administration was lobbying them hard last night. So, unfortunately, this isn't some sort of a math equation that you can figure out, because it's really it's going to be largely influenced by how much pressure S&P will get from the administration. I think, as we've said before earlier in the call, the odds are that there's a downgrade out there, and this plan certainly doesn't seem to be of the magnitude that S&P said it had to see to be considered credible, and so they would be inclined to downgrade sooner rather than later and not wait the 6 months for the next debt commission. But with the amount of with enough influence from Washington, they might be able to take that approach and still save face. At the end of the day, we all know that the rating agencies are trying to gain some credibility, but based on what happened during the whole subprime mortgage crisis, they are susceptible to influence. It's just a question of how much influence they might get from the administration.
One thing, too, we need to all remember is that the market will make the decision for everybody eventually. So, you know, in the final analysis, the market is going to be the final arbiter of what's good and what's bad.
And the second question was in terms of, you know, the U.S. is borrowing 10 years at 2.7%. Do they even consider rates on credits, or is it purely looking at the issuer's ability to repay debt?
Well, the answer is, if you ask them, they would say they look at everything, and they're going to consider all the factors. But of course, the main factors are ability to pay. So I think there's a weighting that takes place there. But the fact that you can borrow cheaply, I don't think weighs heavily in S&P's mind, because that could very well change drastically in the next couple of years, as the U.S. has a very short-term debt structure. It's been trying to lengthen it out, but essentially, actually going back to the Clinton administration, they realized that short rates, they could influence short rates much more than long rates. So if they do that and they keep short rates low and then they borrow short rates, it becomes sort of a self-serving debt structure in a way. But at some point, the market and the bond market vigilantes will not allow that to happen, and rates could rise if who knows whatever events might take place. But rates rise, and then the borrowing costs. So I don't think S&P relies heavily on the cost of debt as much as it is just the ability to repay.
Yeah. That's why, under present circumstances, the idea that we can inflate our way out of this problem doesn't make much sense currently. But as Jeff said, the bond vigilantes would prevent that from happening, particularly if we tried to do it quickly.
Okay. I have one more question that came in. With fiscal austerity and reduced growth rates, what are the chances of a Japan-style deflation?
We're probably in a Japan-like situation now to a degree, but Japan's situation was really worse. They had a much bigger stock market bubble. They had a much bigger real estate bubble, and everything within that country was intertwined to a degree that we don't see today, and they absolutely refused to recognize that the banks had a debt problem for years. They tried to ignore things for probably too long. And without going into a lot of detail, we could end up in a Japan deflationary scenario, but more likely it's going to be something that you might describe as Japan-like, you know, where we have a problem, but it's not like Japan's problem. And Japan's, they have a much older population than we do, too, so they have other issues to deal with.
Thank you.
All right, on behalf of Hancock Horizon Investments, we'd like to thank you all for listening in, and please join us next time. Everyone have a great day. Thanks.